chapter 2 of Philippians. The good news, it's been 5 weeks. This is week number 6. The bad news is that it took us 5 weeks to go through one chapter. So this is the beginning of chapter 2. We'll talk about chapter 2, and we'll continue verse by verse speaking of this conversation. If you have been with us, if you have been with us for the last 5 Sundays or 5 weeks that we covered chapter 1, let me just tell you in a nutshell what that means. That implies that Paul said this very famous quote, famous verse, that he basically closes chapter 1 by saying, for me, Paul says, for me, I don't know about you, but for me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. And we dissected that phrase, and the implication was, at the end, talking about wanted to go with Christ, preferred to be with Christ, and depart from this world. Now, contextualize this conversation, because this is the same guy that in Corinthians speaks about the third heaven. Have you heard that before? That he goes to the third heaven, and he basically comes back and says, you know, things that no ear has ever heard or no eye has ever seen is what God has prepared for those who will follow him. So there is a mystery on the component of what happens after we die. The Bible does not give you details the way we want the details, but there's a mystery in the component. But basically, Paul says, this is the conclusion, for me to be in this world, why I am here, life is a person. Life is not simply the improvement of previous mistakes. Life is not that I go through some difficulties and then I come through and now I'm better. Life is a person, and that person is Jesus. And then he says, but when life ends, then death implies that I have access to this person completely. That's why it's gain. But now he says, but while I'm on this earth, let me tell you about what that means. And he basically taught us for the last few weeks that if you are in this world, the purpose for you to see life as a person, for you to live as Christ, is that we must boast on Jesus. That we must take the person, the character, the worldview of Jesus and enlarge Jesus regardless of the circumstances, in spite of what's going on. Now, if you've been with us for a while also, you probably remember that this is a prison letter. So he's writing from prison. And Paul reminded us that he is incarcerated, but the gospel is not. He's limited because the love of God is experienced under the conditions of God. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, love, that whosoever, the condition, you must believe. Does that make sense? If you don't get the whosoever or the condition, then you create universalism. Universalism says that everybody is a child of God. Everybody's going to heaven. That's universalism. That's not the gospel. So love always provides conditions. He is conditioned in Philippians by being incarcerated. And he reminded us, because for me, life is not the absence of incarceration. Life is not the improvement of where I'm at. Life is a person. Then for me, part of this experience of Jesus is to boast on Jesus. Now, here's what we said last week. And then I'm going to move to the verses for today. What he said, and this is the challenge, because I think everything that I just explained to you sounds very romantic, sounds very doctrinal, sounds biblical. But then here's the implication, and this is where Paul loses me. This is where I'm like, oh man, I don't know. I don't know if I want to do this. I don't know if I want to do the boasting. Because Paul says the boasting, the enlargement of Jesus, is in the context of persecution and suffering. And I'm like, I come from a dysfunctional family. My history is not very, very attractive. And I'm like, that's why I came to Jesus. I don't want any more of this dysfunctionality and brokenness and craziness. Well, apparently Paul says, hey, join the club. Now, as you boast in Jesus, as you enlarge the fame of Jesus, it is not because of the circumstances have improved. It's in spite of the circumstances. Now, here's what he said. He said, I want to join Jesus in his sufferings. But then he said last week, that the joining of Jesus in his sufferings is what brings unity, because now we are united by the sufferings of Jesus. Now, this resonates with me a lot, because I come from a background that what unites me with people is doctrine, is mindset and worldview. When I was single, I was looking for a Christian girl. Singles, right? Well, nothing wrong with marrying a Christian, but Paul says, that's not really unity. That's important, but unity is that you can find singles, an individual, that they also have the same worldview when it comes to suffering. Because it's a matter of time. Your background, childhood, adolescence, young adult, you and I have gone through multiple experiences of difficulties. As a middle-aged guy, I'm in the midst that I just went through two funerals this week. You know, I'm constantly faced with the reality of seeing elderly parents that are gradually, I'm driving to Houston right after church today to MD Anderson to take mom to chemotherapy and things like that. So the point is that it's not whether we have gone or we are going through difficulties. What he's saying is, how do you take the context, the reality of life, and make it an experience where Jesus is boasted, is exalted? And again, as a single individual, you have the beauty that besides the physical attraction, besides that the two of you guys are Christians, besides the dreams and all the desires that you guys have to build a life together, here is the question. Do you have the marks, the scars of the gospel as the common denominator? Because Paul says it is there and only there that you find true unity. Through unity. This is where you find the boasting of Jesus in this context. So today, on chapter 2, he moves us into the therefore. Here is what it implies. If you are united as a church, not just because of doctrine, because where you grew up, and you used to be Catholic, now you're, all this, that's fine. We can talk, and we can kind of, go through those differences or ideals or, views. But Paul says, if our unity is based on the suffering of Christ, if the fame of Jesus continues to grow in spite of our circumstances, Paul says, since that's the case, not if, but since, then you have right now not the improvement of circumstances, you just find encouragement in your circumstances. But don't get too excited, because apparently the encouragement is found not because now you get a better marriage, a better, work experience, a better parenting experience. It's because of the unity that you have with Christ. So I'm going to say this one more time. If you have time tonight and you read chapter 3 of the same book of Philippians, he's going to get into a battle. He's going to argue with the Judaizers. And he's going to go through multiple experiences of what you may call success in his life. And eventually says, I consider all of this as rubbish. It's non-existent, because my goal is to be united with Christ. Now, here's the question. When do you typically need encouragement? When the situation is discouraging. So I'm not prophesizing nor desiring that you find yourself in a discouraged situation, in a situation of discouragement. That's not what I'm asking the Lord. All that I'm asking is that you and I today, we make a conscious decision to be united with Christ. So when, not if, but when the situation gets discouraged, what do you find in the midst of discouragement? You're going to find the unity with Jesus. And I'm going to say this again. Your unity with Jesus cannot simply be doctrinal. I want you to believe what Jesus believed. But it seems to me that the unity with Jesus has to do with the way he suffered. Then he says, I want you to experience, or since you're finding comfort, the comfort comes because of whose love? In other words, be careful that you're not talking about your love, you becoming more compassionate, you becoming more loving, you becoming less hateful, you becoming less combative. Because, let's just be honest, we enjoy company of individuals that they're not troublemakers, right? We love cohesiveness. But Paul says, the comfort is not found on how you guys get along, although you should get along. But the comfort is found that as broken, as dysfunctional, as chaotic the world, family, self can potentially be, you're going to find the exaltation, watch this please, exaltation, improvement, the gradual increase of the love of God in the midst of places where you find no comfort, where you find yourself helpless and hopeless. Have you ever been there? Have you ever found yourself at a place that you are tempering with suicide? Have you ever been in a place where you are ready to give up on this deal? Paul says the antidote is simply the love of Jesus. And then he goes and says, I want you to enjoy since you have found common sharing in the Spirit. And again, it's really hard to read this, because he's speaking to individuals that the churches were completely diverse. between convert Jews, convert Gentiles, convert Romans, convert barbarians. So you can only imagine business meetings in this context. Chaotic, messy, dysfunctional. It's just craziness. And Paul says, you have found the reality of sharing, not in your ethnicity, not on your background and ideologies and dreams and personal preferences and inclinations, firstborns, middle child. Yeah, we can talk about this. But the unity that you find is a supernatural experience of the Spirit of God. That this Spirit is the same Spirit that not only brought Jesus from the death back into life, but that's the Spirit that saved you, Paul says. But this is the unity, or this is the commonality that you find and that you need to live like a safe person. Because here's the bad news of this whole scenario. The bad news is that in reality, verses like this is not a wishful thinking or a wishful desire of Paul that this church will never find themselves discouraged. He's not simply hoping that in your walk as a young man, young adult, elderly person, you never find yourself at a place that you find no comfort. This is not a passage. This is not Paul giving some sort of a therapeutic, message that simply hopefully allows you to find commonality in your relationships. Paul is basically saying, guys, you are the generation that are discouraged. I know because I'm incarcerated and you've been persecuted that right now there's no comfort. You see the Roman government, they're just growing in power and abuse. You may be at the place right now with nothing. You find no commonality around the people that you work with. And for some of us, you may find yourself with family members that you see the distance, the gap, just growing and growing. As an elderly person, you might look around and say, millennials, generation Y, why? I don't understand what's going on today. And you find yourself distant and distant and distant in your relationships. So here's the thing. He places all of this into one single component, which is the character of God, which is compassion. God is a God of compassion. So let me just translate that for us right now in this moment. I participated in two funerals this week. And again, just seeing the departure of men and women. There's a third funeral that I haven't attended. I did not attend, but it was the funeral of a pastor. Pastor here from the Valley. And when I think about those experiences, as a pastor, and I've done a lot of funerals myself, I have never walked into a funeral, grief, sadness, part of the component, but I've never walked into a funeral where people are wondering whether God exists. In most scenarios of life, the issue is not the existence of God. In most scenarios, the question is, does he care in the midst of my situation? So today you may find yourself in a situation where you are falling into the mistake to think that all of these things is simply for the improvement of your condition. And I want you to improve. But would it be possible that the whole conversation of Paul from day one and up to this place, this concept of encouragement, this concept of comfort and unity and compassion, is so you can experience not necessarily a better version of yourself, a better version of the job and the relationship, but would it be possible that although the brokenness of verse 1 is the result of a world that is ruled by Genesis chapter 3? In Genesis chapter 3, the whole scenario that was built and created, watch this, built and created on innocence. Adam was innocent. He was without sin. He did not know rebellion. Chapter 3, serpent shows up. You know the story. She disobeys, he disobeys, they rebel, and then sin entered the world. The consequences of sin creates this brokenness. That instead of us being compassionate to one another, what is the opposite of compassion? Lack of mercy? That's when you give other people what they deserve versus what they need. That's the moment when you pray and you ask God for his mercy, but when you pray for others, you ask for justice. Does that make sense? Now, watch this, please. What we are looking and asking is for the restoration of Genesis chapter 3. Because in Genesis chapter 3, I'm going to say this again. God, man, lost his innocence. Through the person of Jesus and through the compassion of God, God has sent his son. And what Jesus restored wasn't simply a better version of this world or life, of marriage or finances. He restored not simply innocence, he's given us the righteousness of Jesus. That's why Paul speaks of the second Adam. The second Adam is the Adam that he wasn't simply innocent. Jesus was innocent. So when you and I ask the question, why do good people suffer? Have you ever wondered that? Why do bad things happen to good people? Through the lenses of the gospel in Genesis 3, my first question is, who said that we were good? So that's the wrong question, right? If you ask why good people suffer or why bad things happen to good people, that's the wrong question. It's a legit question. It's the wrong question. Because good has only been, in human history, one person was good. His name is? And, look at me. And this good one, with no sin, he volunteered to suffer. So if you find yourself in this place trying to simply improve your situation, I don't think you need Jesus for that. I think you can get therapy. You can get counseling. You can get another degree. You can get companionship. I don't know, whatever. But if you want to face Jesus, you need to be restored. And the restoration of your life is simply that now Paul says, here's the restoration of your life, that when you give to Jesus your discouragement, your sorrow, your grief, your brokenness, your lack of compassion, because your tendency is to give people what they deserve, not what they need, right? That's my tendency. Then Paul says, let me tell you what happens in this legal exchange. At the cross, you gave, verse 1, to Jesus. Discouragement, you gave all these components that we just went through that makes you imperfect. The Genesis 3 world that affected you, you gave it to Jesus. So you have become innocent. He restores you. But the restoration implies on verse 2 that now Jesus, in the exchange, he gives you his grace. He gives you his righteousness. He gives you, watch this please, he gives you himself. And when Jesus comes and dwells in you, the righteousness of Jesus, now you have a joy that is complete. A joy that is not dependent on circumstances, on scenarios, on how people respond to your reality. And this joy is the result or produces a mind, watch this please, a mind that lines up with the mind of Jesus. So this is the moment where you now start thinking differently, not just about yourself, but you think about differently who God is to you. The like-mindedness is the one that is produced having whose love? It's not your love. It's the love of God through Jesus. It's the love of God that brings into one spirit and then also brings you into the experience of lining up your thoughts into the thoughts of Jesus. So today, what I want to remind you is at the exchange of your sin given to Jesus and his righteousness given to you, you come to the realization that this beautiful experience of exchange and restoration reminds you that you are in a limited condition. Paul said it earlier, I'm incarcerated, the gospel is not. Paul said it earlier, he's writing Philippians not after somebody paid the bond and he's out of prison. He's writing Philippians from where? From prison. So this is not wishful thinking. He's building his case literally on the reality that the conditions are limited. That this is not wishful thinking. But the freedom in Jesus, the freedom to be or to become an individual with joy, complete joy, that I'm free not to be dependent on having God as a cosmic butler. I'm free to experience that I can be one, not only with my wife, with my kids, not only in our church, but the oneness in thinking is with the mind of Jesus. That if my thoughts, listen, if my thoughts do not honor Jesus, I do not embrace them. And by the way, here's how you reject the thoughts that do not embrace Jesus. You know how you do that? By embracing the thoughts of Jesus. Because salvation is not just unplugging from self, from damnation, from evil, but salvation is plugging into a person. His name is Jesus. is a person that you welcome. It's a set of values that you embrace of this person and a lifestyle that you adopt into this process. So this morning, I just want to remind you that if we're going to be the generation that we have the freedom to make unlimited choices, the unlimited choices that you have is to choose Jesus, is to choose what is holy and righteous, is to choose and to take every thought captive into the image of Jesus. It's for you to connect your thinking to your behavior, because verse 3, he says, see, verse 3 is not saying get a deeper Bible study so you can fix what you believe. Paul says, I need you to simply put together what you have been taught and you have been trained and you have embraced, meaning theology, doctrine, whatever you've been trained, I need you to be reflected on what you do and how you treat one another. So I want you to stop doing things out of selfish ambition. Because you and I know, when it comes to selfishness, it's like greed. Nobody sees greed in the mirror. We typically say, I'm a go-getter. I'm a firstborn. I love challenges because I'm a fixer. So give it to me and I'll get it done. Anybody? Somebody? Yeah? Some of you middle children are like, that's him. That's her. Right? Listen to me for a second. Watch the language. He's speaking of taking out and removing the obvious. The concept of self-ambition. The concept of vain conceit. How do you do that? Well, again, you recognize the problem. Number one, for these churches, is false teaching. And would you, I know I'm fixing to offend people. I'm fixing to make this very prejudiced against what's going on in our government, in our culture, in our families. But in most scenarios, which is the scenario for these people, the issue is not walking away from the faith, although it is walking away from the faith. The issue in today's culture, false teaching, is mixing Jesus with somebody else. With something else. That's the problem. So how we process life and how we do life needs to be through the exclusivity of the gospel. What Jesus said about himself and what Jesus did based on what he said about himself. And Paul says that is called humility. If you come back next week, Palm Sunday, and especially on Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, we're going to talk about what he means by humility. And humility, just as a preview, is simply valuing others. How do you value others? Now, if we were to do this, just again, I'm fixing to offend people, but hey, that's what I do for a living. If we were to do this verse, do you realize that this will fix abortion? No? Yes? Come on, talk to me. This will fix divorce. This will fix assisted suicide. This will fix not the world, it will fix me and you at a personal level. If I can be the individual that as I think of two funerals this week, as I think about this pastor that just died, can you imagine a generation of men and women right now, right here, in this moment, that we will be remembered for our humility in spite of our doctrine? Can you remember a marriage that what they're known for is how humble they are, and they're raising a generation? Besides the theology, besides the doctrine, besides the, you know, values and attributes, and nothing wrong with those things, but can you imagine a lifestyle that the driving force is putting others above yourself? That will be the generation that is ready to face the reality of persecution. Versus when your driving force is not humility, but instead is self-ambition or vain deceit. That's exactly why when persecution shows up, separates the boys from the men. That's exactly what determines not what you believe, but who you really are. Our prayer, our desire, as we move into the latter part of this Lent season, is for us to stop looking at our own interest. The sacrifice of Jesus is the model that has been imputed and given to us. In other words, this is not just a blueprint on how we should do things. Hear me say this. This is what took place when you embraced Jesus in your heart. When you became a believer of Jesus, a follower of Jesus, you engage into the supernatural ability to stop indulging into your own interest. Following Jesus is simply understanding that whatever was a priority for Jesus becomes my priority. Whatever Jesus did not engage, I do not engage. And whatever Jesus saw in the lives of others, however Jesus put others, the interests of others, above my own interests, Paul says, this is when you engage into relationships in a manner that describes the same mindset of Jesus Christ. 2,000 years ago, Jesus exemplified this as a result of his mindset prior to his arrival. Because you and I know that Christmas, the arrival through this Virgin Mary, the journey of 33 years, specifically the latter 3 years, specifically the passion of Jesus, was never accidental. From day one, God having a conversation as a father with the son, seeing Genesis 3, creating the brokenness of the world, and you and I becoming inheritance, becoming or imputed. We received the sin of Adam, and we were enemies of God. There had to be a conversation between the Father and the Son, that the Father, because he is holy, because he's righteous, his mindset never changes. And God had to place his wrath on someone, because Romans says that the wages of sin is eternal separation from the mind of God. So God, talking to the Son, said, I need you to go and I need you to become the redemption. I need you to make an exchange of mindsets. I need you to move and remove the mindset that was birthed, that was created through rebellion. And I need you to create an exchange where your arrival through a virgin young lady becomes this experience that anybody, whosoever puts their trust in Jesus, will experience the mind of Jesus. But the beauty of this, and here's where I want you to hear this, the beauty of this exchange that is based not just on that conversation, not just on the miracle of the virgin conception or the sacrifice of Jesus, which is perfect. The beauty is that the mindset that you received in Jesus, through Jesus, are his 33 years of life on earth. So when Paul says, I need you to simply base every single relationship in your life through the same mindset as Jesus Christ, is that today, if you are a follower of Jesus, is that you learn, you walk, you embrace, you think, you process life through the mind that Jesus has while he was on earth. Do you know this mind? Do you want to know this mind? Are you willing to make the exchange of your mindset for the mind of Jesus? I'm going to say this one more time. This is not a message of improvement of your mind. This is a message of an exchange of minds for the same mind that Jesus Christ had when he came to this world.